The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Cochran, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 18, 2023. We have three cases on our calendar. The first one is A22-1616, Han versus Jungwirth. Counsel, you should be familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Before you begin speaking, please state your name and your client's name and any preferences on how we reference you. These matters are being recorded. This is the only recording that is permitted of this proceeding. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is JC Johnston. I represent the appellant, Emily Han. Just a little bit of background information. I'm a native of Crookston, Minnesota. I've been licensed in North Dakota since 2008. And this is my second appeal in Minnesota, unbelievably. My last one was a couple weeks ago. And what I learned was that you don't want to hear the facts. You like to hear the legal argument, which is understandable due to the shorter amount of time than we have in North Dakota. As outlined in my briefs, I have several arguments I want to make. But before I start, I just want to know if there's anything in particular that you would like to ask of me on any particular topic before I start. No? Okay. So I came into this case late in the game. It had been litigated for several years before I was asked to become involved. You may ask why I come into a case this late in the game, because it makes it difficult. And I decided that I wanted to try to make a difference for the family, try to do what's best for the child. And so I did come into the case very late in the game. In coming in and observing things, I felt that the right legal standard was not being used, that there was maybe some issues that would make my litigant or my client Emily feel like she wasn't getting a fair shake. And so I did attempt to address those early on through several different motions. Ultimately, we got through the trial and the ruling came back granting Mr. Jungwirth 50-50 custody. The issue that I have with that is I think that the district court used the incorrect legal standard. They found that there was
a change. When you say 50-50 custody, do you mean 50-50 parenting time?
Correct. I'm sorry. Yes, 50-50 parenting time. So week on, week off is what was ordered. They did have joint physical and joint legal custody. And with that equal time, the court changed the primary residence. An endangerment statute was not used. It was a best interest analysis. And it changed the child's primary residence during the school year. What is troubling to me about this is through expert testimony, we have a child with sensory disorders on a 504 at school, and several witnesses testified the importance of a continuity to his schedule and the difficulties he established through transitions to the home. And
Ms. Johnston, I don't disagree with the premise that the district court did not apply the Christensen factors in determining whether this was a de facto substantial change in custody. But my question is if we remanded it to the district court for application of those factors, what is the indication that the result would be any difference? In other words, why isn't this a harmless error?
Well, I do feel that if it was remanded, you know, there's other issues that I briefed as well concerning the expert testimony and the discounting of all of the expert testimony under the theory that they didn't interview the other side, that they did.
But if we remanded it, the decision would not be based on what was elicited during the evidentiary hearing. It would only be based on manner in which the motion was framed by father. That's what Christensen directs us. At least that's my read of Christensen. So yeah. My question is what about the notice of motion and motion, the relief that's being sought by father, is indicative of any potential change in the outcome if we were to remand this case to the district court?
Well, because I don't feel that the district court can do week on, week off. It's a de facto change in custody from what the parenting time was allotted before. And so it's my position that we can't have 50-50 without the endangerment statute being met.
Well, why is that the case? Because Christensen does, I think, pretty, again, this is my read of the case, pretty clearly direct us that the definition of a substantial change in custody cannot be determined by allocation of time alone, that it's a totality of the circumstances analysis. So I'm going to return to my original question. What are the other indicators about father's motion that would indicate that the district court might be inclined to apply an endangerment standard?
Well, he should have applied the endangerment statute to do any change, so the argument is it's a de facto change in custody, but he used the best interest analysis. He should have used the endangerment analysis. And so all of his findings don't address how this child is endangered and why there should be a change that would justify what his outcome was.
If the district court were to have applied the totality of the circumstances test, how would that have, in your view, led to the conclusion that there was a change in custody? Would necessitate applying the endangerment standard.
Right. And when Christensen and V. Healy came down the first time, I actually litigated a case under the first one before it was reversed on the second one. And what I did there was it was a joint physical and legal custody. And we did modify the parenting time between 45% and 55% because the first case said it wasn't a de facto change in custody. When Healy 2 came down, everything changed. And what the case law says is, like in Ayers, is when you have parenting time that results in an impact to the child's daily care and control, then the de facto change in custody is present. And so changing the time from 60% to 30% to 50-50 and changing the primary residence of this child's home, certainly, and then using the best interest factors, all of it is just an error of law from the way I read Christensen. Does that answer your question?
I think so. You're saying it's an error in law because the district court didn't apply the totality of the circumstances standard.
Yeah, well, there was several things. I think the problem.
And I guess my question was, if the district court had applied that standard, how would it have reached the conclusion that reached the conclusion that there was a change in custody? And I think you answered that. I mean, that's basically your position, is that there was a change in custody, so the endangerment standard should have been applied. Is that correct?
Correct.
But the district court didn't actually go through the totality of the circumstances analysis to determine whether or not there was a change in custody.
Right. I think that because the wrong standard was used throughout, and I mean, I argued this in briefings throughout the motion process, that defining what primary residence was and defining what physical custody was and legal custody and how, you can't change the child's primary residence. And I don't feel that I was heard on that issue. The court decided it was a best interest analysis, and that in light of that, that was the outcome. The other part at the initial trial, and again, before my involvement, there was a triggering event that put in that said, if dad moves within 20 or 25 miles of mom's residence, this is grounds to revisit everything. And looking at that language, it's basically a triggering event based on a future occurrence, which is against law as well. And I feel that dad took this language And this has been the impetus behind him returning to court over and over again to undo the initial results from the first trial. And, you know, I tried to point that out as well, and I don't feel that the district court heard me on that issue. The other issue was the experts that we had lined up to come in, and the determination by the district court that if I hadn't lined them up to interview the opposing litigant, that, you know, that there wasn't much weight to their testimony. And in my understanding of experts, my experts are for my side of the case. And if opposing counsel has a differing view, they get their own experts. I didn't understand the rationale that I have to have my experts that I've retained and asked to review documents fully allow the other side to present their side of the case before their testimony will even be considered by the court. That's not my understanding of how the expert issue works. And I feel that it was an error to discredit or not take and put the appropriate weight on all of these experts, because really that was the piece that tied kind of the big puzzle together of what's going on in this case. You know, in particularly the domestic violence, initially the district court did find there was domestic violence in this case, but Judge Marvin said, I just can't determine who the perpetrator was based on everything I've heard over this 9 or 10 day trial. You know, when we have a finding of domestic violence, that really goes against doing this joint decision making and putting these people in position to continually report to one another. But if we look forward after the original trial, and at the time we tried this last hearing, there was a lot of evidence to suggest who the perpetrator probably was if Judge Marvin didn't have a sense of that at the first hearing. And I think when we go into all the issues of the financial control, the coercive control, you know, all the conflict over decision-making for this child, whether he should have proceedings, have his tonsils out. I mean, it all kind of feeds into the overall picture in this case of what is going on and how the court can help improve the situation for this child by making changes to take these parents out of the position they're in right now by the continual contact, the reporting back, the having to make joint decisions. And, you know, so that all kind of ties in to the case as well. The other thing that concerned me was the temporary order in the parenting investigator, how the court did not hold the parenting investigator to task, how the parent investigator waited months before she even tried to reach out to any of the experts that she should have. She had months and months and months. And we filed motions and
counsel, I see that you're running short on time. I do have one question before your time expires.
Okay.
One of the arguments that you're asserting on appeal is that the district court abused its discretion in not awarding mother need-based attorney fees. And it is a voluminous record, so I may have missed it, but I did not see a motion for attorney fees that was brought by mom before the district court. Can you point that to me in the record?
I can look on it when Ms. Alba is arguing. I believe that it's always a standard in our motions to request attorney's fees. So I would go back and look in my motions while.
All right. I know you're new to the case, but I just did not see a separate motion for attorney fees.
I don't think there was a separate motion. I do think it was requested as relief within some of our filed motions. And we did talk about it a little bit at trial, and I tried to elicit some testimony concerning fees, and the judge did not want to hear some of my positions as to how Ms. Alba was being paid, or if Mr. Youngworth's former attorney, now live-in girlfriend, is still litigating behind the scenes. I wasn't allowed to explore that. The child support is...
And there was no offer of proof made. There was no motion filed. Is that correct?
For attorney's fees?
Yeah.
There was no separate motion for fees.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So the custody investigator then entered this temporary report, and the parent investigator and the district court used the temporary order against Emily in the end result, saying that, well, he's already got this much parenting time, so it's not as substantial as a change as it would have been from the original judgment. Number one, I don't understand how the temporary order was even entered, because this wasn't a case of originating jurisdiction. And number two, Mr. Youngworth already had appropriate parenting time. So the way I read the statute, there shouldn't have even been a temporary order issued in this case, and then subsequently used against Emily in the end decision. And then again, you know, the custody investigator tied into our request to recuse the judge because his wife is a partner at the same firm as the parent investigator.
Counsel, I see that your time has expired. You will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. All right. Thank you very much. Should have noted at the beginning of the argument, I did see in the briefing and in the record that there was a expert witness that shares my same last name. I am not related to that expert witness. I don't know that person. So I just wanted to make sure that everyone was aware of that. All right. Counsel, go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court, Justice Frisch, Justice Wheelock, Justice Cochran. My name is Jennifer Alba, and I represent the appellee respondent in this matter, Mr. David Youngworth. Ultimately, we're requesting that this court affirm the district court's decision in this matter. I'll start out by giving my roadmap. I'll begin by discussing the first issue and how the district court did not err in granting my client the appellee in an evidentiary hearing and ultimately modifying parenting time in this matter. I'll discuss how the district court did not err in finding the appellee established a material change of circumstances, how the district court appropriately applied the best interest factors with the evidence before it, how the district court did not err by dismissing the appellant's motion to dismiss motion of respondent or in the alternative counter motion to amend judgment. I will explain that the district court did consider the testimony of the experts in this file, and the court's findings are supported by the evidence in the record. I'll discuss how the district court appropriately recognized that there was no domestic violence in this case, and how the district court appropriately entered a temporary order. The district court did not err by presiding over the instant case and relying upon the parenting investigator's report. The district court did not err in its modification of the child support calculation in this matter. Finally, I will discuss that the appellant failed to meet her burden of proof in requesting need-based attorney's fees. With respect to the very first issue, whether or not the district court erred in granting the appellee an evidentiary hearing and modifying the parenting time in this matter, ultimately, the issue before the court is whether there was a de facto modification of physical custody and primary residence of the minor child. While the appellant properly states the legal standard for a motion to modify custody pursuant to Minnesota Statute 518.18, it's not applicable in this case because the appellee filed a motion to modify parenting time pursuant to 518.75. And like the court previously noted when the appellant was arguing, it's more than just a focus of time. In the appellant's brief on this issue, that was the sole focus, was the fact that the appellee's time increased from 33% to 50%.
You would agree that Christensen controls, right?
Correct, Your Honor. The totality of the circumstances test does control in this matter. I would
completely agree. So when I look at the district court's order from September 23rd, 2020, which is the order that determines that the best interest standard applies and not the endangerment standard, it does not appear to me that the district court is applying a totality of the circumstances test. Can you show me where in this order where it's doing that?
I would agree, Your Honor, that it's not explicitly stated that the totality of the circumstances test was utilized by the district court. However, it is used throughout the findings to justify the court's order. And I would agree that—
Which findings in this order?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Are you talking about the second amended findings of fact?
No, I mean, when I read Christensen, it appears to me that the Supreme Court is directing district courts to examine the motion to modify to determine whether it's a de facto change, right? So, yes, so I think that it's, and to determine whether an evidentiary hearing is warranted. So I think we have to divorce the evidentiary hearing and the subsequent order from the determination of whether the best interest standard or the endangerment standard applies. So when I look at the 2020 order, I'm struggling to find findings where the district court is applying the totality of circumstances.
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. I understand. Your Honor, I understand. No, I thought you were discussing the most recent second amended findings of fact and judgment. I would agree with you. However, I would also argue that it would be harmless error due to the evidence presented and the ultimate determination and review of the totality of the circumstances in the court's second amended findings of fact and judgment.
Why is that?
I believe, Your Honor, it's harmless error because the court did go through the factors that are also outlined in Bayer v. Bayer. The district court discussed the age of the child. It found that both parents participated in the minor child's therapy, that they can each provide adequate care for the minor child. It discussed the length or the distance between the parties and their residence, which is approximately 20 minutes. It discussed that the minor child was accustomed to both homes, that he has a loving and close relationship with both parents.
And would you consider, and those findings are based on the evidence that was elicited at the evidentiary hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, correct.
So when I look at father's initial motion, he's also asking for some additional decision, some removal of decision-making authority from mom and sole decision-making authority assigned to dad, right?
That was in our initial motion, yes, Your Honor.
And would that be something that if we consider the totality of the circumstances, or if the district court considered the totality of the circumstances, would indicate that perhaps the endangerment standard would apply? It would lean towards a de facto change?
Perhaps, Your Honor, if we look back at his initial motion, there were allegations that decisions were being inappropriately made and that were not in the best interest of the child. So I think if we were presented with whether or not we had to meet that endangerment standard, excuse me, with respect to that specific issue and the removal of decision-making, we would have been able to prove that there was an endangerment to the minor child in this case.
And is that, I mean, then my next question is it appropriate for us to make that decision instead of sending it back to the district court to do the weighing of the totality of the circumstances? I'm concerned about some of our Supreme Court's directions to us that we're not tasked with the opportunity to weigh or reweigh the evidence. And that's a task that is exclusively within the province of the district court. So I'm uncomfortable doing that. So if there's some authority that would enable us to do that, I'm interested to hear that.
And Your Honor, I'm not off the top of my head aware of any explicit authority. However, I think we need to look, I understand where the court's coming from, but the bottom line, I do think that this is, if error at all, is harmless error, considering everything else that was presented to the court. I don't think that this ended up being a de facto change in custody, considering all of the evidence that was presented. And if we look past the initial motion, we look back to that very first amended judgment, it did have this triggering sort of provision that allowed my client, Mr. Youngworth, the appellee, to prove a material change in circumstances to go back and revisit parenting time. Now, I understand that the appellant disagrees with that provision. However, it's important to note that there was no appeal taken from that first amended judgment. This is ultimately the very first time that anyone is hearing that she disagreed with the implementation of that provision.
Is that a final order? It doesn't seem to me to be a final order when there's an evidentiary hearing that's...
Oh, Your Honor, I'm talking about the very first amended judgment that was entered back in 2018. Okay. There was the provision in there indicating that if Mr. Youngworth, the appellee, moved within 20 miles of the minor child's residence, that would trigger the material change of circumstances and the court would review the best interest factors in whether or not his parenting time should be expanded. Now, that has been in the first amended judgment since 2018. There was no appeal taken from that. And if you review the record, and it's cited in my brief, the parties actually talked about this on the record in the motion to reconsider that was previously heard by Judge Marbin before Judge Harbit took over the file. And in that proceeding on the motion for reconsideration, the parties discussed hypothetical situations that would alleviate the endangerment statute, the appellee having to meet that endangerment statute. They discussed, you know, what sort of language would both parties be pacified with in the future if this did happen. And it did.
Counsel, maybe you can direct me to the language of the order, but I don't recall that the triggering language specifically referenced application of the best interest factors.
If you
maybe I'm wrong about that.
You're not specifically wrong. I would never tell a judge or justice that they are wrong.
I could be, and you know, it's an extensive record, so I can't claim to have memorized it all. So please correct me if I'm wrong.
It is in a transcript that I attached. I cannot recall. I'd have to find what part of the addendum it is in, but it's in a transcript where the parties discussed it on the record and indicated that it was understood he would not have to prove the endangerment statute. He would have to actually just prove that it was in the best interest of the child if he did relocate within 20 miles. And again, it's important to note that this was discussed on the record, and the parties seemed to implicitly agree that this was going to be the standard moving forward. And it was always understood from both parties that Mr. Youngworth was eventually going to relocate closer to the minor child. And the very first custody evaluation also indicated the parties should have 50-50 parenting time. They were supposed to have equal parenting time, but for the appellant relocating to Grand Forks from their initial residence. Now, I just like
to clarify, it's not in the order itself. Your understanding is it's a discussion between the parties that's part of the transcript.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe it's on appellee's addendum 22.
118. Okay.
It's in there somewhere. I apologize for not having that
page
right off the top of my head. I'd like to go into the analysis of the best interest factors. It was hard to decipher what appellant is actually taking issue with. The second amended findings of fact is quite substantial, and the court went through specifically every best interest factor and analyzed the evidence and testimony before it. And it went through all 12 of the best interest factors identified in Minnesota Statute 518.17, and it determined that an equal parenting time schedule was appropriate and in the minor child's best interest. If we move on to the dismissal of the appellant's motion to dismiss, motion of respondent, or an alternative counter motion to amend judgment that was filed late in the proceeding. The first point, Your Honors, is that it's not properly before the court. It did not follow the Minnesota General Rules of Practice. There was no affidavit. It relied solely on a brief executed by appellant's attorney. And the appellant goes on to boldly contend that it was dismissed by the district court without reason. That's absolutely inaccurate. In the district court's April 21st, 2022 findings of fact and order, the district court went through and explained it considered the motion and it considered a motion to reconsider based upon the fact that the appellant had filed a similar motion that the court also previously dismissed. The district court also noted that the motion came 18 months after the denial of the previous motion. So the appellant was given a basis for its dismissal. And the district court did not err in dismissing that motion. Now, with respect to the expert testimony, there was some discussion when the appellant made her initial argument that it wasn't considered by the court. That's completely inaccurate. The expert witnesses were qualified as experts. The testimony was considered by the court. The court goes to great lengths in its second amended findings of fact to discuss why it did not give weight to certain expert witnesses' testimony. With respect to Ms. Laura Frisch, she was the expert witness on domestic violence. She testified that she'd not reviewed all of the emails. She'd not reviewed all of the pleadings. She hadn't even had any contact with the respondent, the appellant, or the appellee since the new proceeding had started. Moreover, with respect to Mr. Hart, who was the appellant's counselor or therapist at that time, he had very little interaction with her. She had just started seeing him a couple of months before trial. He wasn't able to make a diagnosis. And again, he had not reviewed a significant amount of information. With respect to the occupational therapist, Ilse Claussen, the court describes very specifically why it gave her testimony less weight. And that was because on the second or third day of trial, we discovered that the occupational therapist was a relative of the appellant's attorney. And that was not previously disclosed. Ms. Claussen conceded on the stand that she had talked to the appellant's attorney in preparation for trial, but had not talked to the custody evaluator. With respect, Your Honors, to just very briefly on the temporary order, temporary orders are not appealable. Case law is very firm on this issue. They're not appealable. Moreover, the parties, as I indicate in my brief, agreed to the entry of the temporary order on the record, and that was later solidified in an order from the court. Ultimately, Your Honor, in conclusion, Mr. Youngworth respectfully requests this court affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, counsel. Ms. Johnston, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you. I want to cover a few things that the district court didn't cover. The findings weren't extensive, in my opinion. The district court didn't address the play therapy records of the child, the comments from the speech therapist concerning the child and the parents' inability to work together, the OT's testimony about the parents' inability to work together. They didn't discuss the child reporting missing mom during dad's parenting time, or how the child defecated his pants at 8 years old on parenting time exchanges. The parenting time expediter had put in place a neutral exchange through a supervised facility in Grand Forks where the defecating of the pants stopped. But the custody investigator, the most recent one, removed that restriction and the child started defecating his pants again. The concerning thing to me in this case is that the attention isn't per se on the child. How is this child doing in school? What parent is more in tune with this child's needs? What effect does dad and mom attending the same events have on the child? These were all things discussed by specialists. These parents are so difficult to work with, providers will not even stay on the case with them. They have lost so many providers that takes away consistency and continuity for this child, and the district court failed to even recognize that evidence. As far as the experts, I think that the reason why the CI had not spoken to the occupational therapist is because she waited till 2 weeks before trial. The occupational therapist had changed jobs and the new employer would not allow it. It had nothing to do with me. If we look at the motion that was filed with Emily, there were several motions filed, and the last motion that the court failed to consider was simply asking for some alternative relief at the hearing. There was one motion filed previously with affidavit outlining all the complaints. The second one just said, in case that none of the other arguments work, this is some alternative relief we want you to consider. The court would not consider any alternative relief for Emily, no matter what. And I think that that was also an error. As far as the argument concerning the best interest factor, I have an issue with the other side saying, well, she agreed to it. She agreed to this. She agreed to the parenting investigator. I compare this to like criminal cases. When you have a substantial right that's given up by a litigant, sure, the judge said, my wife's in the same firm. But he did not give them the opportunity for counsel and lawyer to speak privately, and he did not ask the parties to consent on the record. The same is true with this best interest argument that they agreed to a lesser standard. There was nothing on the record that the litigants agreed to a lesser standard. It's all attorney argument. And so these assertions that there's bald-faced lies or that they did consent, no, they didn't. There was nothing on the record with the litigant saying, yes, I agree to this. And I think we could read into it a little bit that the former attorney before me is not on the case anymore. So there was clearly something that made them part ways. As far as remanding, I think this case warrants a straight reversal. The improper law was used. I feel that considerable evidence was ignored. I feel that Judge Harbaugh was maybe not happy with my request to recuse him. And I think throughout the case, I mean, he even reversed himself on the bench. At first, he wasn't even going to allow us to have experts until we had to go home and brief it. And then he reversed himself the next morning. This case is a mess, I will agree, for a number of different reasons. But I think that the court's focus needs to be on this child, what is best for this child, what is going to be best for this child going forward, and what the district court did does not serve the best interests of this young man. And so I respectfully say I'm out of time, and I wish you all a good day.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted, and we'll take it under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you very much.
Thank you.